In memory of Buddy, Buddy's parents, Anna and Ron, are listeners and patrons of Time to Talk TFMR.
This podcast is supported by ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. ARC is the only UK nationwide charity offering non-directive, individualised information and support to parents who are making decisions around antenatal screening and diagnostic testing. They also provide specialised bereavement care for those who experience termination for medical reasons. For more information or support, please call ARC on 0207 713 7486.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. I'm Hayley, and today we are talking about genetic testing and hereditary conditions. So since we've started the podcast, I've spoken to a lot of you, I've had your messages, we've shared some of your stories around hereditary conditions, around chromosomal issues, all of those sorts of things. And we've done a couple of episodes before about this, but today we've got Jane Fisher, the Director of Antenatal Results and Choices, and Dagmar Tapon, who's a genetic counsellor working in the NHS. So welcome both. It's an episode we've wanted to do for a little while. Jane, you and I have talked about it for, you know, the last sort of year or so about wanting to do this.
We have, and I'm really glad we have Dagmar here as the expert voice, because we hear regularly from parents who get very confused when they hear the word genetics and jump to the conclusion that anything genetic is something that's always inherited, it's something they carry, etc. So it would be really good to clarify a few things today.
Yeah, that's great. And Dagmar, it's, as Jane said, it's great to have you here as our expert. So welcome.
Hello. Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
So why don't we start with what you do? What is a genetic counsellor?
Yeah, so it's quite timely, actually, because yesterday was Genetic Cancer Awareness Day.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'm very happy to tell you what we do. So as genetic counselors, basically our role is sort of twofold. And one part is education. So that includes explaining about options for genetic testing and then genetic test results, discussing those, interpreting risk assessment. But I think even more important is the second part of the role, which is the counseling side. And that's really to address the psychosocial side of all these tests and help families adjust to diagnoses, make sense of it, what it means for them, also help them decide whether they want to have a test or what to make with it later on. And to hopefully empower them sort of dealing with any diagnoses in the family.
Yeah. And Jane, I mean, you're on the end of a telephone taking calls when people first get these diagnoses or if these words start to be said to them. So I'm just curious about, yeah, your experience of what it's like.
It's often so challenging because they're dealing with the factual information, which often is quite complicated. And I think it's important to note that in the last few years, genetic testing has moved on really at a pace. And we now pick up smaller and smaller changes that people like Dagmar can be less confident about what the outlook might be. So we deal with a lot of uncertainty from information from genetic tests. And parents have to work out in a state of high anxiety, and they're emotionally fraught what that information means to them and that the decisions they might face as a consequence of the information. So it's really tough.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, when I put the question out on our social media saying, you know, we're going to be doing this podcast recording, what questions do you have out there? And I mean, people responded quite fully, which was great. And we've got lots of questions to get through. But the sort of overriding feeling was a sense of overwhelm and confusion. And when you talk about the counseling part of your job, Dagmar, is that?
Yes. And I totally agree with Jane that I think there is a lot of difficulties understanding what's going on and making sense of it all. Maybe sometimes thinking a test could look for everything when it was a very targeted test. And it is complex and complicated. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that you've got lots of questions.
Yeah. Well, so one of those questions, a very sort of scientific question, was, you know, what is the difference between genes and chromosomes?
Yeah. So, I mean, chromosomes are the structures within the cells that make up our bodies that contain all our genetic material. Mm-hmm. And we used to compare them to books. Maybe a more modern analogy would be to compare them to the internet. So there's basically lots of information, mm-hmm. and they contain lots of genes. And the genes are like the recipe to make a dish or something like that. So the genes really hold the important information.
Right.
And chromosomes usually come in pairs, because usually there's one inherited from the egg and one from the sperm. So 23 pairs in total. But then if you look at how many genes we have, it's over 20,000. Right. So obviously there is a difference in scope, whether you do chromosome testing or genetic testing. And I think some confusion comes when people had a chromosome test, and then later something is picked up in a single gene and they didn't realize that that wasn't tested for with the initial test.
Yeah. So I think what I'm hearing there is that you can do this testing, which is involving the chromosomes, which may or may not show up something, and may or may not show up something that's related to the gene in that chromosome or in those chromosomes. I don't know. I'm not a scientist.
Yeah, I think
help me, Dagmar.
It depends what you look at.
Yeah.
So if you suspect a chromosome condition, for example, you would do a different test than if you're looking for a genetic condition.
Yeah. So they won't necessarily show up on the same test. You will have to do different tests for different things. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, so for example, my daughter Luna had Turner syndrome. So my understanding of that is that it's a X chromosome disorder. She only had one X chromosome. And that I was also told that this is not hereditary, or it's very, very, very unlikely to be hereditary. So therefore, we didn't go through any further genetic testing in that regards. That was that. You know, and we've had some questions around T21 as well. So can you just maybe just talk us through those types of conditions, something like Turner's or T21, what's involved in that kind of testing?
Yeah, so those conditions are due to the baby having an extra or missing whole chromosome. Mm. And they are probably the most well-known conditions, are among the most common ones. So Turner syndrome actually is quite common. Mm-hmm. Early on in the pregnancy, but because there is a high risk of the pregnancy ending in a miscarriage, often by the time people have a scan, it's sort of not an issue anymore. Mm. And Down syndrome would be an extra chromosome. And because these conditions are usually out of the blue, meaning they can literally happen in any pregnancy. So there is testing offered to everyone. So it's usually not targeted testing. So anyone pregnant in this country can have a screening test for Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And that would be different from someone with a family history, for example, of a particular genetic condition. Testing then would only be offered to that family, but not to their neighbor, because they don't have a higher chance for that.
Yeah. Okay. And Jane, just so we can get a sense of when you were taking calls, you know, the amount of calls that you're taking for random chromosome or random, you know, physiological, you know, how the baby is developing and forming versus genetic. What's the sort of percentage here we're talking?
So do you mean random, what can be random chromosome or genetic conditions and those that are inherited?
Yes, exactly. Sorry.
Well,
yes.
I can easily say that the vast, vast majority of calls we take are from people who are dealing with random events.
Right. Okay.
It's much rarer. Well, that reflects the reality. Inherited conditions are much rarer than the random events. And so we don't speak to so many people that have inherited conditions. And that can be helpful for people to know that It's usually the fact in most pregnancies that a genetic condition is a one-off.
Right. Okay. So can we just, because I'm a little bit confused. So when we talk about genetic conditions, but not necessarily hereditary, can you please explain?
Yeah, I mean, we would probably want to distinguish between a chromosome condition or a genetic condition, but that's a bit sort of picking on the details. I think the big difference really is whether it is sporadic or inherited. And most chromosome conditions are sporadic. Most genetic conditions that affect the pregnancy are also sporadic.
Okay.
And only sometimes is it actually due to a change that one of the parents passed on, or maybe both parents passed on.
Okay.
Yes. I think it can be confusing because genetic condition now is a very broad term, and it's used, it encapsulates chromosomal conditions as well, which it does make it confusing.
Okay. But no, that's really good to sort of clarify that. So we can have sporadic events that are affecting genes and sporadic events that are affecting chromosomes. And then we can have hereditary, which comes from one or both of the parents.
Yes. And in fact, both chromosome and genetic conditions can be inherited.
Okay. Okay. Right. So, I mean, I'd like to know kind of limits of genetic testing. That was actually my personal question. You know, what can we know and what can we not know?
Yeah, I think it is a very difficult question, actually, because again, it depends a bit what you're testing for. So I think the bottom line is we cannot test for everything. And most testing is targeted, and there is different reasons for that. One being the chance of actually finding something. You wouldn't really want to test for something that's ultra rare if you're not suspecting to find that. But equally, not all testing gives a clear answer. And I think that is one of the big problems with genetic testing. So when we're talking about a pregnancy, for example, we are usually starting with scan findings. So we are suspecting that there may be something going on, and we're trying to find a cause of that. And we, at the moment, wouldn't really recommend, for example, that someone who has an entirely sort of normal going, healthy pregnancy with normal scans and blood tests and all of that does genetic testing, because often we find changes in genes that we don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
So it can create more confusion with the associated anxiety rather than the certainty and maybe reassurance that people were hoping to have.
Yeah.
So really the testing usually is to answer a particular question.
Can I just come in there? I think it's a really important question, this, because it's about managing expectations. And I think we live in an era where we hear all these phrases like genomics bandied about, and we can, if we want to, actually map all a baby's genetic code if we wanted to. But if we did that, we'd throw up so much information that we knew very little about that it would be impossible to work out what's important, what's not important. And I think it's really vital that parents recognize that, yes, we can do this genetic testing, but we're still at the tip of the iceberg in being able to explain genetic changes.
Well, and I guess there's an argument to say, like, if, for example, if my genes were tested and were, you know, just analyzed in this sort of way, that it might highlight and say, oh, you know, you might be susceptible for this, that, and the other. But it's a,
yeah.
I might not. It might happen. It might not. So there's, yeah, it's a kind of, it makes me think, well, how much do you really want to know? And what is, Dagmar, I think what you were saying, what actually is helpful in being able to make some decisions, and what's just causing anxiety for something that may not even happen, or we don't know exactly what it means even.
Yeah, so because most of this genetic, or as Jane said, genomic testing is still quite new, what we need to be aware of is that between us, we all carry millions of changes in this genetic material, in the DNA. And while some of them will cause problems with our health or with the baby's development, others will not. Mm. And for many of these millions of changes, we don't know yet what they do or don't do. So I think that the knowledge we can get from the testing is really still limited, even nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm thinking about when I was when we were told about Luna, and it's a spectrum disorder. Mm-hmm. So there is no testing that could tell us, yeah, she has Turner syndrome and she will definitely, become blind when she's 22 or something like that. Or you know, like these are all possibilities that will happen. We don't know if they will happen. We don't know to what severity. And there's that level of unknown. So yeah, it wasn't possible to look at that. And I can remember Brenda Kelly, the fetal medicine consultant that we had on, and her talking about how them as consultants, if there's something structural going on, they can tell with a fairly good certainty of what's happening structurally. But when it comes to developmentally, they're in the dark, really. There is no testing to tell us how this baby will be affected.
Yeah, and that is the case really for most chromosome and genetic conditions. So even when we make a diagnosis, there is variation. And in most cases, we don't know why that is, whether it's other genetic changes or other factors that contribute.
Mm. And do you think, does testing give false hope? So could testing, I mean, the other thing I picked up on was people wanting to know as much information as possible, but also not knowing what they're asking for, if that makes sense. So a bit blind and hoping that these tests are going to tell them everything. And of course, what I'm hearing is that they likely won't. So how do you navigate that, Dagmar? I mean, when you're with a client and they're hoping this test is going to tell them what they want to hear, how do you navigate that?
Yeah, so I mean, we should maybe also briefly just mention that there is a difference between screening tests and diagnostic tests. With the screening tests, people need to be aware that they don't give a definite answer anyway. They will always just sort of say either higher chance or lower chance.
Mm-hmm.
And diagnostic tests are usually only offered if we are already suspecting something. And then it comes back to that question, what are we looking for? We're now trying to find out a yes or no answer. Does the baby have this?
Mm-hmm.
Keeping in mind that even when we find something, there is still the variability that we cannot predict. And if we don't find anything, that could just mean that we haven't looked at the right genes. So,
right.
For example, where there is multiple problems with a baby's development, a heart defect, something not right with the brain, I mean, whatever, we think it sort of seems to look genetic. The chromosomes are normal. We know it's not one of those common conditions. And then we do the more detailed genetic testing, and it comes back and nothing has been found. I mean, that happens regularly. That still doesn't mean the baby definitely doesn't have a genetic condition. It means that with the current knowledge, the current technology, we can't find it yet. But then also to keep in mind that not every time that a baby doesn't develop the way they should, is it actually because of a genetic or chromosome problem. There are other reasons, like infections or something in the environment or medications, whatever. Often we don't even know why.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just know, I mean, Jane, you can probably speak to this as well, that, you know, when you find something's wrong and then you just want as much information as possible, it feels overwhelming, or at least I can speak for myself. I wanted as much information as possible. I would think that that's probably true for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then to be met with a kind of, yeah, we're able to tell you this, but not that. I mean, that I can remember feeling this sense of, well, how am I supposed to make some decisions here if I don't have the full picture? I mean, we've talked about this before in general of, you know, you're met with an unclear picture. I mean, would you say that people who Let's switch to hereditary for a moment. Is there more of a sense of, I'm not sure what to do here, or I haven't got a clear picture? Or is it more clear because it's hereditary? They know it's come from one or both parents.
Well, the factor with some inherited conditions is that some couples, and we've certainly spoken to them, will have children with the condition.
Yeah.
And that makes the decision-making very complicated because they're weighing up if the child they have and has a fairly serious condition but is doing quite well, they may feel, well, we may continue this pregnancy, but this child might not do as well. And how will it impact on the child we have? So that can make it very complicated. And for those women that do end the pregnancy, they can have complex feelings around, what does this say about my relationship with the child I have?
Yeah.
So that adds another dimension, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And we interviewed Kelsey actually in the States, and she had a daughter with the condition, very, very rare condition. It was a hereditary condition and subsequently had three more terminations for the same condition. And she spoke really eloquently about exactly what you're talking about, Jane.
And how difficult that the pregnancy itself, when they know, and this is in a pregnancy, you know, where they're going through a pregnancy knowing they're going to be tested and potentially face the decision to terminate, and how they negotiate that difficult relationship with the baby they're carrying and distancing themselves from that. But at the same time, and I remember really vividly a woman who was a volunteer for us who carried a condition where it was a 50-50 chance of her baby having the condition. She had, I think, three terminations because it fell the wrong side. But she was really clear. Obviously, they were very difficult experiences, but she was somebody who was incredibly positive about the provision of termination for medical reasons.
Yeah.
Because she said, without that, I would not have a family.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it, really, to think about it in those terms. Yeah, it's probably a similar feeling for Kelsey, you know, that this was a way at the time. IVF was not an option. They live in the States. They couldn't afford it. And so this was the only way to be able to potentially build their family. And she was really grateful to be able to have that. And it was a double-edged sword, but yeah. So anybody listening wants to go back and listen to Kelsey. That was an amazing episode. Dagmar, I wanted to ask you, I'm going to go back to some terminology now. What does balanced translocation mean?
Yeah, so if we remember these little chromosomes that we spoke about earlier, so these little structures, translocation basically is when parts of one chromosome has sort of broken off and attached itself to a different chromosome and vice versa. So a little bit has swapped place.
Yeah.
But balance then means everything is there. So there's nothing extra, there is nothing missing. And that's why it will usually not affect the person themselves who is a carrier of it. But the problem for someone who is a carrier of a balanced translocation is that when they produce egg or sperm cells, there is then a higher risk that it could go wrong. And yeah, so the baby then ends up with extra or missing chromosome material, which can then be more severe or milder depending on what that material is.
And is there multiple conditions that would be the case for a balanced translocation or a translocation issue?
Yeah, I mean, you can basically be a carrier of any chromosome translocation, whether it's chromosome 1 or 2 or the X chromosome, any in between.
Yeah. And then that will have a effect on, so potentially on the baby, and it could, depending on what chromosomes are affected, that will then present itself in various different forms. Would it be mostly structural?
It can be anything. It would depend on the genes that are in the area that could be extra or missing.
Okay. Yeah. And you can see how complex that then is, because actually it's like a very personal disorder in a way, you know, so it's a very, not necessarily has a name to it that you could find in a textbook.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of these translocations are actually very rare.
Right.
But then if you look at all the different translocations that we know about and you look how many people actually carry such a translocation, it's about 1 in 500, something like that. So overall, they are common, but each individual one is rare.
I'm going to ask another technical question. What does an X-linked carrier mean?
So that's usually when there is a change. So one of these variants that can cause a condition in a gene that is on the X chromosome. And most women have two X chromosomes. Most men have one X and one Y chromosome. There is generally different genes on the Y chromosome. So that's why usually men will have only one copy of the genes on the X chromosome, while us women usually have two copies. And therefore, many X-linked conditions will only affect boys, but not girls. So a woman who is a carrier generally has no signs of the condition herself.
Right. And so for example, my husband is red-green colorblind.
Yeah.
Am I right in understanding that that's an X carrier?
Yes, correct. So he would pass on his X chromosome to his daughters.
Yeah.
Because they will always get an X from you. They will always sort of be genetically female.
Yeah.
So they will probably be okay.
Yeah.
But then their sons, so your grandsons, would be at risk of being colorblind.
Right. Okay. I did a bit of research and I went, oh, I know this one. Okay. So I'm going to switch to some listener specific questions. And we had a question from Vicky over on social media, and she's right at the start of this. She's just found out that something's going on. And I think she had the general kind of question of, what do I need to know? Or what question should I be asking now at the start of this process? Dagmar?
Yes, I think so. One question she needs to ask herself, or everyone does, is how much information do you want to have? So the doctors will then usually offer further testing, whether to have those or not, what they would do with the information. And then, to ask, what are those tests? How good are they at picking up whatever the people who are looking after her are suspecting? If genetic testing is offered, that usually comes with a whole discussion around risk of finding something uncertain, something unexpected. But generally, at least here in the UK, we try to keep it specific to the problem found in the pregnancy. So here we try not to really look, for example, for adult onset conditions.
Yeah.
Because that will confuse the whole thing even more. So I think we're trying to help parents with the situation they are in at the moment without giving them too much additional stress.
Perhaps I'd add too something that we would explore on a helpline to somebody who just had the suggestion of potentially an issue is to check where they're being looked after.
Okay.
The level of expertise they have around them, because obviously Dagmar sits in a specialist hospital in London. So there are fetal medicine specialists there that are very good at scanning. Mm. And often it can be important if she wants more information that she's had really good scans of her baby so they can really get a sense of anything structural that might suggest a particular genetic condition. So one of the first questions we would ask, where are you? Who are you being seen by? So that we could check that she is in expert hands.
Yeah, because the sense I was getting as Dagmar was talking, like, okay, let's try and slow it down in this process. As someone who has been in, to an extent of having genetic testing, I had a CVS, you know, and so slowing down to a point where you can really think about what tests am I having? What tests do I want? What can they tell me? Who is it that's doing them and who is it that's analyzing them? Yeah, and being able to take a bit of a breath and take one step at a time. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's really about being able to process everything. And we have parents who say, I want all the testing today, but actually they need a bit of time for it to sink in. And I think sometimes even just a few hours to maybe go and have a chat with someone else about it, or really just to realize what's going on, so that you can then decide what to do. Do you want another test or not?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm just wondering, Jane, you know, you mentioned that about who is it, you know, which hospital, who are you with? Can people make requests? So can they sort of say, okay, I'd really like to go to, I don't know, for example, the hospital that Dagmar is at, because I know that they're really good at this, or they have a very good team. I mean, you know, are we talking about postcode lotteries here, really? I mean, that's...
Yes and no. I think that in general, there is very good practice out there, and the more local hospitals will recognize that they have a limitation to their expertise and will refer people on into specialist hospitals. And I'll admit that if we sense that that's not happening, we will encourage parents to ask their local team, could I be referred? Because we have a good knowledge of what's out there nationally. Could I be referred to X hospital?
Yeah. And I guess this is for our listeners who are not in the UK. This is obviously, you know, if you're in the States, for example, if you're in the US, then you have a lot more freedom around this because you're paying for it. So, you know, that's a different sort of system to us here in the UK. But I think I just wanted to sort of touch on that because we're all based at the moment. We're all talking from the UK. Okay. And I mean, another listener question around that was from Beck in Australia. And she had a condition, again, I think she's at the beginning of finding out what's going on, but the word pathogenic was used. And it was specifically around that word that she was really confused about. What does this mean?
Yeah, pathogenic really is a term people in the lab use when they find one of these genetic variants that is thought to actually cause a condition, a health problem.
Okay.
The opposite would sort of be benign or neutral. So some of these changes, they don't seem to do anything. Mm-hmm. They don't cause disease, but pathogenic would mean that they are expected to cause disease.
Okay, so a change in that gene would be expected to cause a particular disease, whatever that might be.
Yeah, in fact, that particular change. And you could have another change in the same gene that is maybe carried by lots of healthy people. So it doesn't cause any issues.
Yeah, okay. So it's just another term within the terms that can be used, really, about...
Yeah, so I mean, these changes, we often say they're like typos. And some type errors are, you can forgive them, you can still read the sentence, but others are so severe that they really interrupt the sentence and it doesn't make any sense anymore. And that's what pathogenic would mean.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Maybe a more general question. Can anyone have genetic testing? I think I kind of noted this answer because it sort of relates to what we were talking about how much do you want to know and how much can we know, really? But could anybody, theoretically, if something's found to be wrong, say, I insist on having full genetic testing on myself and on my baby, for example?
Yeah, so in a pregnancy where there are scan findings, whether a genetic, so one of these new genomic tests is then offered really depends on the chance that something is identified. There are some scan abnormalities that are more likely to be genetic and others that are more likely to be due to something else. And it's in the cases where we think it may well be genetic that the genetic testing is offered. It has to really start with whoever we think is affected. So in the case of the pregnancy, the baby, because it may not have been inherited. So testing the parents isn't really going to help us. We would only test the parents if we find something in the baby that we think could be inherited. And then we are testing the parents specifically for that particular change.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember, so again, you know, a difference between UK and US systems, again, healthcare systems, here, the NHS takes a kind of step-by-step approach. And perhaps in the US, there might be a different approach because you're paying for it or your insurance company is paying for it. You may say, well, I would like this. And if your insurance company says, yes, sure, we'll pay for that, then you go and have it. So again, I'm just noticing differences in how systems might work.
Yeah, but I mean, I would argue that even in the States, if you have a normal pregnancy with normal scans, everything looking fine, and you request genetic testing, you would have that difficulty of interpreting the changes.
Okay.
Because you're doing testing on what looks like a healthy person, and we wouldn't be able to necessarily know if a change then causes a health problem later on or not.
Okay.
And I think even in the States, they do have professional bodies like our Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that give out guidance that people follow on the whole.
Yeah.
That it's not a good idea to test for everything, and it should be targeted to what might be relevant in a particular pregnancy because of scan findings, etc.
Would that also extend to, because I'm just remembering a US listener, and she's been on the podcast a couple of times as well, and she found out that they were carrying, I think both of them were carrying a hereditary condition that they were passing on to their pregnancies. And I remember her saying, oh, I think everybody should have genetic testing on themselves to find out whether they have something that could be hereditary and passed on to their babies. And I remember her sort of saying that, and there being a kind of, well, no. I mean, is that what we're kind of talking about here? That no.
Well, I mean, there is some call for preconception.
Yes, that's what she was talking
about.
Couples,
yeah. Looking for particular things, not everything, yeah. But looking for particularly serious conditions.
Yeah.
So that couples, and in some cultures, they do that.
Yeah, yeah.
They do that when they know there's a particular condition that, but I don't think you can't test for everything. That's the difficulty.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what I'm getting to here is that I think when parents find out, some parents, when they find out there's a problem, I've got a hereditary condition that I'm passing on to my baby, there can be this sort of reaction of, well, why wasn't I tested before? Or I should have been tested, or everybody should be tested because I've been through this awful situation. And just going back to the psychology part of this, or the, you know, the emotional side of this, sometimes I do find it quite tricky. We're dealing with quite medical. I feel even this episode, I'm feeling like we're kind of talking about it on a quite sort of unemotional level here. This is what we're doing. But what we're talking about is people's lives and their family planning and building and whatnot. And with that comes a huge emotional.
And with hereditary conditions, you've got, there can be the tension between couples if one is the carrier of this change and difficult feelings around that. For the grandparents, it can be difficult because they know that their children are grappling with these difficult issues because it's something they've inherited from them. So it has, as I'm sure Dagmar will vouch for, it has a real ripple effect across whole families. It can be really tough to deal with.
Yeah, it can cause a lot of feelings of guilt and also culturally getting married, finding a partner and all of that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's really tricky territory. And I just wanted, very complex. And I think I just wanted to name that for everybody listening as well, that this is very complex. Dagmar, so on that note, what is your role in that? You mentioned right at the beginning that the most important role you feel is this counseling part. Do you want to just speak a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it is to support parents really when they find themselves in such a situation, whether it is a one-off or inherited, to help them sort of navigate the information, the testing, and then decide how they want to proceed with their families. I mean, where I work, people often say just the fact that they are able to call a number and know whoever picks up will understand is really helpful, rather than calling a helpline, getting a midwife who has no idea about the condition or anything like that. Many families that I look after also, I've known some of them for many years. So that's quite nice, obviously, for them and for me to be able to support them throughout several pregnancies. And it includes conversations, how to deal with an affected pregnancy, if they decide to terminate, and then also future what's the chance it could happen again, what to try, what testing to have. And again, sometimes people say just having a plan helps them to put things a bit in perspective. And also even the best plans, I think, are not always things happen. But at least knowing what to expect can help, I think.
Yeah. And maybe on that note, you know, what are the other options? So some of the questions that came in, again, from different parts of the world around subsequent pregnancies. And I almost got the people didn't say this, but I got the feeling of what are the least bad options, you know, because it kind of sometimes feels like that, especially if you live somewhere where you're not going to get IVF on a health service, you know, and even within this country, you may not get the IVF on the health service. So yeah, what are options are available?
Yeah, I mean, I think on paper, there are lots of options. But if you look at each one of them, indeed, none of them are great. No. So I think the least
bad. That's why I called it least bad.
That's quite good, definitely. So, I mean, I think probably most couples go for the sort of technically easiest route, which is just to try for another natural pregnancy, which also, in most cases, gives the best chance of having a healthy baby, and is often the quickest pathway. But then obviously there are then those choices about, do they want the testing and what would they do if the baby is affected? But yeah, for most people, the chance of having a healthy baby that way is far greater than the chance of. But as we've already had a few examples that you mentioned, it can lead to needing three terminations for the same condition, absolutely. Then I think the next option is what often sounds great. Let's just go for IVF. So if that is offered on the NHS, and then the embryo can be tested for the inherited condition, and you just use one of the healthy embryos for implantation, have a pregnancy, voila, have your healthy baby. But the whole IVF process is very intense, lots of appointments, possible side effects of the drugs, takes a long time to work it up in the lab, doesn't always work. So the success rate overall is, for most couples, probably lower than trying natural pregnancy.
So can we just talk about the success rate? Because I think one of the questions, now this was in America, I don't know if there's, I wouldn't imagine it'd be different in America or here, but what is this? Let's just be honest about the success rate of IVF, because I don't think there is honest discussion about that.
Yes, I mean, I feel you should probably ask an IVF specialist.
Sure, okay, all right. We'll caveat this that you are not an IVF specialist.
So I think for people who are looking into this, the questions to ask is what figures are being quoted, because different labs have a different way of quoting it. So for example, some say, well, once we transfer an embryo, then there is a more than 50% chance of it working. So that may sound quite nice, but because there's many different steps involved, and at any of these steps, it may not work. From actually referring a couple for a first consultation and then starting all the testing and everything to have a healthy baby at the end, to my knowledge, the success rate is around 30%. It will be age-related, other factors play a role, but just to give a ballpark figure.
Okay. No, I think that's really helpful because it's really hard to find that sort of information. I mean, and there's lots of other podcasts, and as Dagmar said, there's, you know, you need to speak to those sorts of specialists. So if you are thinking of going down that route, really ask your detailed questions about the whole process and what are the percentages. It's really tricky.
Yes. In the UK, we have an organization who keeps figures and has some information, which is the HFEA, the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority. And it's quite sort of lay people friendly to look at.
Okay. I'll put that in the notes for everyone as well. That's really helpful. I want to ask these two questions because, again, these were listener specific and specific disorders or diseases. And the first one was in the cases of Huntington's disease. And this came from a question on Instagram. And the question was around them as a carrier, but it's not affecting them, and knowing they're a carrier and deciding whether or not to have their embryos, fetuses tested, babies tested for Huntington's, because she had been told if there is a positive there, their baby is carrying Huntington's, they must terminate the pregnancy. So her question was, is that true? Is that right? Because she also knows people who found out and then decided to carry and do whatever they did.
Yeah, very difficult.
Yeah, really so, tricky.
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry, Dagmar.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to have to be in that situation. So I think it comes a bit down to why do you do the test and what do you do with the information? Obviously, no one can force anyone to have a termination.
Yeah, that was my feeling, yeah.
It's sort of with the understanding that if someone goes through the whole prenatal testing, they have a reason to do that. The testing would generally be invasive anyway.
Yeah.
And really, when we do testing in pregnancy or if they then don't terminate, that will obviously become a child and eventually a grown-up, then was it in the best interest of the child to have done that test during the pregnancy? Because if you don't have a termination, this person, there is a result already. So you've taken away the autonomy of that person to know or not know. I mean, we all have a right not to know.
Yeah.
So usually we would only do genetic testing prenatally or in childhood if it affects the management in any way. Mm-hmm. Is there any treatment that needs to be started early? And if that's not the case, then because there is no benefit really for the child, there are then potentially more harms.
Yeah.
And that includes, emotionally, discrimination, problems with insurance, employment. So it's really weighing up the benefits of why would you want to do it? Is it just to satisfy your own curiosity or do you have other reasons versus what are the implications for this child that grows up and will probably not develop any symptoms for 40, 50 years?
Yeah. I can think of a really interesting example of this. A couple we dealt with some years ago now, and the mother knew she carried Huntington's gene and absolutely agreed with her genetic counsellor that should the baby be found to be a carrier, they would terminate the pregnancy. When it came to it, she was still thinking that that was the best option. It was her partner that said, you can't do this. And it was really interesting when we talked more about that. And there was something about, for him, ending that pregnancy said something about what was ahead with his partner, knowing she had this debilitating condition. And he was of the mind that, no, we'll carry on because they'll find a cure.
Right.
They'll find a cure for this and it'll all be okay, because he was working through what he knew was ahead with his wife. And it was really, really complicated and emotionally difficult, that. Whereas she was being much more practical, thinking, we can't do this to our child. Leave them know it. No, we know that our child has this condition. Really complicated.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the genetic counseling comes in, because you try and have the discussion with both parents before the testing to try and think about how would we feel. And if one of the parents says, well, there may well be a treatment or a cure in 40 years' time, then why do the test during the pregnancy? Maybe then it would be better not to test in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. Really complex. Really complex.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, also that difficulty, we don't know how we will feel when there is a result.
No, that's it.
That's what I thought. It's like, well, I might decide, yes, okay, I want the testing, and then find out, okay, I'm pregnant, I have the testing. You know, you find out your baby has Huntington's, and then you've fallen in love with the fact that you're pregnant and this is a baby that's coming. I'm in love with this baby, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can see how, again, it's almost this trying to future think, which is tricky. It's really hard.
It is. Yes.
Really
definitely.
Hard. Okay. The other specific question, so Kim sent in this question, and it was around osteogenesis imperfecta, if I said that right.
Yeah.
and she wanted to know how parents pass this on and what the odds are for happening again. And I think from my memory, I think it's her son that had it, and his was very severe. And I, again, from memory, I think she has a child who is healthy. Yeah.
Right. So I would definitely recommend that she goes to see her local genetic counselor.
Yeah.
Because there are actually different types of osteogenesis imperfecta, and they are inherited in different ways. So again, many of them happen out of the blue, just sporadically with a low chance of happening again, but there are some inherited types as well.
Okay.
But that should be possible to find out from genetic testing.
Okay. Yeah, it's a very complex subject. I'm really glad that we're covering it. I feel like there's more for us to do here. Yeah, okay. So, okay, I'm just going to say Fiona's sent me a question. She wants to know, Dagmar, do you know everything about all these different possible conditions? I mean, Dagmar, like, how much do you need to know about all these different conditions? I mean, how clever are you, Dagmar? Tell us.
Well, I'm, of course, immensely clever.
Genius.
I would answer that probably none of us know about all these genetic conditions. Yeah. There are thousands of them.
Yeah.
And also, there are still new ones being discovered all the time.
Yeah.
So I think unless you spend the whole day just reading up about the latest medical literature on new gene discoveries, and anyway, no one can remember all of this, but we usually know where to look it up. So
good.
That's our trick.
You're good in the library. I like
yes,
it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Because I can imagine literally this morning I was thinking, God, there's thousands of things that can go wrong.
Yes.
In a pregnancy.
And also, actually, another thing is things are evolving.
Yeah.
So for some things that we thought we knew, then a few years later, we realize, oh, actually, it's not as simple as that. It's a lot more complex. There are other genes or whatever.
Yeah. So I think the takeaway I'm getting here is that it is complex and we don't know everything. In fact, we're scratching the surface.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
I think we know very little.
Yeah.
And I guess on that note, I think I want to leave with a bit of hope. So even though we're scratching the surface and even though we don't know everything, we have people in place and doctors in place to help with this process. We have genetic counselors like Dagmar. We have places like ARC and Jane on the lines to help people to figure out what's best for them.
We do. We could do with more. We could do with cloning Dagmar.
Yes.
Just today I was at a meeting where they were talking about a new network of young genetic counsellors that are really interested in getting involved prenatally to be the new Dagmars. And I think there are quite a number of people that want to do that, that recognise the need. So I would hope over the coming time we will get more people in place. We desperately need that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. But also there are other ways to find help, like for the specific conditions, maybe a support group if you want to know more about the condition.
Yeah. And we can certainly help at ARC in signposting people to relevant organizations that know about particular genetic conditions.
Mm. Okay, well, Dagmar, at the end of our episodes, we do something called TFMR Takeaways, and it's basically a sort of piece of advice or piece of hope, you know, something that you can offer to parents, one thing that they need to bear in mind or think about.
I can think of lots of things, but getting support to help them through the pathway. Asking for referral to local genetic counselor or geneticist.
Yeah.
And remember, I think what parents often say is, well, I've been the one, therefore bad things happen to me. Mm-hmm. But that's actually not the way it works. I know that's what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
But most people we see back in their future pregnancies, everything is actually fine. And really most couples do manage to have families they want. It may take a bit more time, a few more tries, but I think having the emotional strength, then generally they will manage some way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I can probably chip in to say that both Dagmar and I have been doing our jobs for a long time. We won't name the number of years. But I don't want to speak for Dagmar, but I think we both probably say that if it weren't the case that most couples did get there in the end and have positive outcomes, and most, yes, will have their family or healthy babies, but even those that aren't able to do that do restore hope. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then we wouldn't have stayed doing this work. Am I right, Dagmar? Mm.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is hope. Mm. There is life. And the support is there. We'll put some of the suggested places to look for that support in the show notes. And that's really great. I really appreciate both of you coming on and giving your time. I think it's going to be a really good episode for everyone to hear. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. This ensures you get all of our new episodes as soon as they're released, and you can find us on most podcasting platforms. We also love to hear from you, so please get in touch. You can find us over on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Time to Talk TFMR and Twitter at Talk TFMR. So that's all for this time. Thank you so much, and please take gentle care of yourselves.